Welcome, friends, to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are one of two dozen United Lodges around the world dedicated to, we spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy according to the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. We have several activities during the week. We have two public meetings that you can engage in. They are on Wednesday evenings at 5:15, the door opens, and from 5:15 to 7:15, the library is open. There's a librarian there for your direction, and the reference for the evening, the evening's class is always there. And there's a book table open before and after the meeting where straight line theosophical writings are sold at cost, and a couple of them are even free, or very, very reasonably priced. So on Sundays, the doors open at 10:30, and the meeting starts promptly at 11 and ends promptly at 12. So we'd like to read the declaration. All of our contribution, all efforts here are voluntary, of time, money, and service. All are needed, all are most welcome, but there is no obligation, there's nothing imposed or implied. All free will offerings of time, money, and service. So we would like to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study or otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, for Sundays, we have an overall heading for the month, an umbrella topic, and we're coming to the close of the first quarter of the year here, and we want to remind everyone that this this coming Wednesday is William Q. Judge Day, which is a devotional meeting, and we ask all to be seated at least 5 minutes before the beginning of the meeting and to be in a quiet, meditative atmosphere. So the talk will be William Q. Judge, philosopher, guide, and friend. And so the topic for, and spring is coming, believe it or not. The topic for this month, which will, is called The Mysteries of the Mind. So we've already heard about the origin and nature of faith, the genius within. Today it is instinct and intuition, which are two inner guides. And the next Sunday is the mind, an entity, principle, and faculty. So without further ado, we have two short talks, and then we will have a discussion and comments and discussion. So instinct is the first part. It's a universal endowment of nature. It is in everywhere and in everything. It is in the lower kingdoms, it's an automatic response. It's a reflex reaction, as it were. But there's always, everything comes from spirit, from the one life, the one spirit. And so in the lower kingdoms, such as sea urchins and mollusks and whatnot, their instinct is innate, and it's just impulse. They literally, we were reading where the little sea urchins and mollusks, for just a few hours, they actually swim, and then the beginning of their life, and then they attach themselves to, you know, a rock or coral or whatnot, and then they just kind of sit there and wait for food to float by, and then they suck it in. So this is perhaps, at least in the lower kingdoms, this is the most basic rudimentary form of life. It's one that, you know, they don't have brains, as it were, but they do have intelligence. And we're told too in the philosophy that the brain is an instrument, but it is not, you know, but there is intelligence everywhere throughout nature. So in the other kingdoms, instinct is more like in the plant kingdom. Well, in the mineral kingdom, it's cohesion. That is their instinct. They know what to attract and to repulse. It's everything is electromagnetic. And in fact, you know, we have the magnetic North Pole. And so in the mineral kingdom, it's cohesion, and it attracts what it needs. It repulses what it rejects what it doesn't need. And in the plant kingdom, we have, of course, we have sensation. And we have a little bit of limited mobility, in that the plants always, they seek the sun. They're always seeking and moving in the direction of the sun. So then in the animal kingdom, we have much more highly developed instincts, and we have mobility. And animals, they operate on instinct. It's a group, in a sense, it's a group soul or a group mind, and it's the experience of their whatever. If the tigers acts one way, you know, the prey and the hunted and the hunter, they all have natural defenses. It may be as simple as just the coloration or being able to burrow underground to escape danger, you know. But of course, we have the apex predators as well. So instinct is, again, a universal endowment of nature. It is the spirit of deity itself, and It is a slow development of the physical constitution, an evolution of our adult material brain. So this instinct is a divine spark, and the first stage of action is the nervous system, and so it becomes more complex. There's a double evolution of physically and spiritually. So, but we need to understand that that reason develops at the expense of instinct. That before humanity evolved into the, there's involution and evolution. So everything comes from above, from spirit. And as we took on our coats of skin, because we were once, you know, our astral bodies, we were very ethereal. As we took on our coats of skin and had to interact more and more with nature, we used reason more and more. But reason is just for the material world. It's, we go from premises to conclusion. We make decisions, but it is not really spiritual in nature. It can be, ideally, that we wed our instincts and our reason and our intuition along with our intelligence, and that then by self-induced and self-devised means, we progress along the path. So intelligence is the ability to understand, to perceive, to discern, to choose. Instinct and intelligence are two faculties completely opposed in their nature. In a sense, they are two enemies confronting each other in constant conflict. So man is endowed with reason. Now the infant has instinct, but the young animal shows more of both than the child. So the child has to be taught what is dangerous, what is to be avoided, and what is not, to beware of drowning, to beware of fire, whereas animals, they're born with these instincts and they know. We had a quote here. There's a quote from Hippocrates that we'd like to read. It's, we see indicated the way to man to find relief for all his physical ailings. It is the instinct of the earlier races, when cold reason had not yet obscured man's inner vision. Its indication must never be disdained, for it is to instinct alone that we owe our first remedies. Again, reason is a byproduct of the senses and our physical brain. It cannot be a quality pertaining to our divine spirit. So, at this point, we didn't want to talk about intuition because although instinct and intuition are very much related, our second speaker here is going to go into intuition.
And what was just said is really key. The full title for today is Instinct and Intuition, Inner Guides. We're reminded that life is, that soul is, that the conditions as expressed just a bit ago limit the ability to express soul, and that there is a point in evolution where soul in the human kingdom is a communion, it's a conjoining, it's a celebration of three streams of evolution. an instinct, as was said, there is a degree of direct perception of what is right within the conditions of that particular life form. Reason is said to be kind of a pivotal balance, if you will, that the human uses very expressly, balancing between instinct and intuition. In a variety of places in the philosophy, HPB points out that reason is the faculty that the human uses to distinguish, to define, to reason out what is being perceived. But intuition is the potential full expression of soul in the human state. We see it fully expressed across time and places among all peoples in the great souls or the wise ones or the Mahatmas. And what we're looking at in intuition is the same direct cognition enhanced. So in the animal kingdom, there's a direct perception of what is right and what to act on. In intuition in the human state, we have instinct of soul. We have a direct cognition of the truth in all things, and an abstraction, a degree of self-awareness and abstraction of morality and discernment that can only bloom in the human state. Even if we think about Coco the gorilla, who has hit the TV sets recently as they're celebrating Mr. Rogers, there's a film clip of Mr. Rogers with Coco. We see very, very strong limits as to what can be done within her form and expression. So instinct in the animal world is said to be an Atma Buddhi, a monadic essence that is enhanced, if you will, when soul is expressed in the human state, where Atma, Buddhi, and Manas, or mind, fully come together. So, what is it to be human? As we sit here this morning, we have the power to transcend our conditions. We are able to be self-conscious. In other words, we can think about how we're thinking. We can observe, the eye can observe how the mind is working, how the emotions are working, what the body feels like, experience that, and then make decisions and choices, because free will and choice comes with this degree of mindfulness. Our aspirations, of course, as Plato said, to be holy and wise and just is to be intuitive. Our aspirations is to hold as many noble degrees or direct perceptions or intuitive concepts that we can, to enliven them in our daily thought and action and word. And in that way, what happens with the intuitive process is that what is perceived at this particular state is able to be impressed in the eternal nature. It back, so we say we take our minds and unify it or synthesize it with the heart, and then we, all of that impress, all of that energy that we put to that is lovingly incorporated, if you will, in the eternal mind, the universal. What another thing that is a difference in these two inner guides is that it's truly only in the human that the karmic agent is the soul. That creative process of being self-conscious, of having both instinct and intuition, that determines the future of evolution for all aspects of soul. It is said that the real man lives in and through thought or mind, using brain and body, but the real man is soul. So how do we begin to live to develop this intuition, this potential power in each one? Well, there's an article called Though Dead, Yet She Still Speaks. It's an HPB anthology article. It's in a three-set volume. And HPB advises that each morning upon awakening, that we renew a vow to try to live the day in harmony with the higher self. And her emphasis in the paragraph is about the word try, to really try to imagine what it would be like to live the day moment by moment in harmony with the highest aspect of nobility or altruism or charity that we can envision, and then to move through the day making that attempt and then letting go of the process. That natural evolution, based on that motivation, based on that sustained attempt, will take over. Elsewhere, she writes that the intuition in man carries with it all the knowledge existing in his real nature, and that intuitive sense through reincarnation is potentially active in our innermost being, comes to us in deep sleep and dreams, is the sum total of past experience. And even then, in one of her articles, she says that intuition is not infallible. We can still, in this attempt at processing thought and trying to perceive the truth and trying to determine and discern the right course of action, that we can use reason and instinct and be getting confused. So she points out that as we look at theosophy, this ancient school of wisdom, based on the intuition of a long line of seers and sages, that this is an unbroken oral tradition, that it really is unaltered. It has come to us from the darkest prehistoric times we can vision all the way through to modern times. And yet, along the way, intuitive, full expressions of soul and humanity constantly double-check with each other to make sure that intuition and the lines laid down are still one and the same. And we do that for ourselves in a certain way. As we try to lead a life based on right morality, as we make this effort to listen to the voice of silence, that voice of conscience within, we try very hard to discern what it is we're thinking, to figure out, well, this is animal instinct and personal. This other thing we reason through is, gee, that was a flash of intuition. That was a spark of insight that seems to be pure and true. In that effort, as soul, we make every effort to make the brain porous. So, as my coworker said just a little bit ago, the newborn infant human exhibits pure instinct. A brand new, still wet, newly born baby knows it doesn't want to fall and has a grasping instinct to cling immediately. Instinct in that little human is based often on smell, because even the eyesight is still a bit confused. So that baby can smell the source of food and knows how to travel or to root on the mother to get to a point where it can be fed. And then gradually across the first 7 or so years of life, we see that primate instinct begin to very gradually give way to something more. And we see in the growing child a sense of self, a sense of what is fair and what is purely kind, but still an instinct operating to be safe, to be well-fed, to be loved or affiliated, to be safe in all ways. And it's after the age of 7 as we see conscience fully come in, the ego or the eternal soul fully connect with the incarnation, that we see across time at different rates, each human developing reason, experimenting with the environment to see ethics and not beginning to express a fuller knowledge of right and wrong and detaching from reward. And very gradually, a sense of compassion begins to emerge, hopefully, if the conditions are right in that soul-created existence. So two inner guides, two different degrees of soul, certainly both very, very useful in incarnation.
So your questions and comments are invited at this time. Yes?
One of the purposes, I think HPP states, for writing the secret doctrine is to help develop the intuition and the grace. Mm-hmm. Now, the concept of reincarnation, we have to use our intuition. The concept of universal brotherhood, a fact of nature, is like we have to use our intuition to try to comprehend that. So, do these exercises help develop the intuition then? Like reading the secret doctrine and trying to understand it?
Mm-hmm. The secret doctrine, as many of us know, you don't pick it up and read it from page one all the way to the end of volume two. Because it's written in these incredible nuggets of, you'll be reading along for maybe a page or two, and then all of a sudden the information has shifted and you're brought up short and said, well, wait a minute. It's a treasure hunt in a certain way. So yes, when we're reading the secret doctrine, we do use the words and we are reasoning in a particular way, but we also are sparking the ability to read with in between the lines and interpret the meanings and to say, well, wait a minute, this paragraph is really more like something I read 25 pages before, or this paragraph is actually the key to a paragraph that comes much, much later, like 100 pages later. So that exercise of being in the moment, focusing our intellect, our ability to think, focusing our perception, and then having the ability to say, wait a second, let me read into that one word. How many different ways could that one word change the meaning of that sentence? And in using that kind of expansive thought, more abstraction, more interpretation, we begin to make the brain more porous so that we're more alert to the intuition and we're more capable of sensing it and using it. Meditation might be another tool.
And we would recommend too, or suggest, that reading Isis Unveiled before reading the Secret Doctrine or reading them together. You could do that, but Isis Unveiled is a good background for the Secret Doctrine, and it could be read cover to cover. It's more accessible. But in order to develop, apparently the Secret Doctrine is written on two levels higher than our normal everyday thinking. And it's like a birthing. It's like we're forcing ourselves to be, it's a process of birthing the soul bit by bit. It's a long and slow process, which takes many lifetimes, of course.
Yeah, the other thought that came to mind while you were talking was that if we're holding an idea that puzzles us and we've considered something, we've pondered it, and it's still puzzling us, a technique to use the secret doctrine is just to sit quietly for a minute, hold the idea that we've been considering or puzzling, and then let the book fall open and read what's on those couple of pages and see if there's not a hint about an avenue of research that we could do, or maybe is there an answer or suggestion along the lines of the questioning we've been doing.
We think there's a term for that. It's called bibliomancy, perhaps. Yeah. There's we've come across that. It's in a sense, it's everything is connected, as it were. So we're going to get something of value that we can use. It's very practical. It's not. Go ahead. You had a follow up.
Well, yes. There's also a thing called the index.
Right. Yes.
Yes, the index. That's very helpful. Like if you have an idea, like reincarnation, and how do I consider this? What are the many viewpoints that I can use to understand this? And you know, there's a heading, reincarnation, and there's a list of pages, and it helps broaden our understanding or perspective, I should say.
And when you use an index, when I use an index, we're using the power to discern and define, aren't we? And that falls into the category of reason. When we use a meditative book like The Voice of the Silence, Light on the Path, Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, poetry, other scriptures from around the world, and we're reading them like they were symbolic in poetry, we step from reason into an intuitive sense. It's a different application of the use of mind.
And there's also an excellent glossary that we have, which was assembled from HBB's notes after she left the scene. And she had many notes scattered all over because she was constantly writing, not using a typewriter either. This was longhand. So we can just imagine how laborious a process it was. But the glossary can really shed a lot of light on various various terms and mythology, and just there's a whole cornucopia of knowledge in there, little nuggets. There was a hand all the way in the back first. Yes.
Yes, we were wondering about this idea of sense of consciousness, that even little children, tiny children that are just starting out and starting to communicate with other children, we wonder, where does that come from, that feeling of this is right and this is wrong? That's not fair, but this is fair. We're talking little children, but yet it's innate in them. Where is it coming from?
Well, theosophically, the answer would lie in the duality of the human being. That although the baby, the toddler, looks like a brand new physical person, a unique incarnation, and in some ways the arrangement maybe of the molecules of the brain and the body and the scandic tendencies of that little personality, they may be newly devised. What is working at all times above and beyond manifestation, above and beyond the physical and the psychic, is spirit. So resident in spirit are certain impressed ideas about the true nature of self, about the eternity of that self, the oneness and inclusiveness of self, cause and effect and justice, and the confidence that I'm going to progress and grow and expand, and even the sense of life is here for all and to serve all. So those innate ideas are impressed in the Buddhi in the Buddhi nature, in that eternal aspect of memory, And they do find expression because their spiritual instinct, they continue to come through in the very early years of life, unless and until there are some intervening decisions and experiences that cause the child to be perverted off course. There's an example, an analogy I guess we could use. You know how in all the ancient cultures, the symbol of the circle with the point in the middle is symbolic of spirit in manifestation of the all and this expansion of life where universal brotherhood in spirit is a reality, an eternity, a guide, literally an inner guide for how we should be expressing life. Well, if you think about it in the human state, the baby has an eye with a pupil. And what's one of the couple of first things that a human infant can see is the caregiver, that eye with that dot in the middle, that pupil, and the nipple and an areola, or the top of a baby bottle, which is still concentric circles. And so that symbol is there from stage one. As life proceeds, that baby's eyes will expand and glow and shine with joy, first for the caregivers, first for the face of the mirror. So instinctually, they will find safety in what's familiar around them, most like them. But soul, expressed after seven, those eyes will continue to have an expanding pupil to let in more and more light, to let in more and more love from more and more and more faces, conditions, qualities, as long as the child is not trained and reconditioned for causeless hate. That process will continue.
So also, when we first became, when humanity first became embodied 18 million years ago, when we separated into the male and female, and we're just beginning our experience with this plane, this matter, this substance that we deal with every day, we had initiates and divine instructors who impressed all this knowledge on us, and everything is there, it's all innate. Through instinct and intuition, we were trying to draw it out because through misuse and misapplication of over these millions of years, falling deeper and deeper into matter and becoming more entwined in the web of matter and using reason rather than our instinct and our intuition, which they can both be destroyed by using strict reason, materialistic reasoning. But there's this, what was impressed on us besides all the knowledge of the arts and science was this sense of devotion. There was pure love and pure devotion, and we were devoted to our teachers, to the initiates, to the hierophants, the king initiates. But there came a point when they had to leave the scene because, you need to graduate. You need to go and make your own mistakes and test, check, and verify. But that's what the child has. That's the beauty of a very young child, is that sense of devotion, that sense of love. As long as they're nurtured and cared for. And then hopefully that is continued. There's nothing worse than seeing a child that's from a very early age is given too many shocks of the reality, doses of reality, of so-called reality of the world and the hardships and the negativity and whatnot. But we guess that all of that is karmic. It's in a sense. Did you, you had your hand up here?
Always kept in mind the terms analogy and correspondence. And when we do that, we try to think of the ideas or instances or circumstances which are comparable to the topic, and gradually our intuition, which you already know, helps us get a better picture. And we were thinking of such stories that have always interested us, Tarzan and the Apes, a human being living in animals, Dr. Livingston in Africa, South Africa. And there are numerous circumstances, Lewis and Clark. So our question is, where is the headquarters for all of this evolution that's taking place around us in this world?
Where is the headquarters? Well, everything comes from spirit. It's deity. We would say it's deity. It all flows from deity. It's all a part of deity. Now, if we're talking about in our nature, it's the monad, which is one. The monad is everywhere and in everything. The highest two principles, of which everything is sevenfold, but all of life participates in the highest two principles, which are Atma and Buddhi, which is spiritual soul, and Buddhi being intuition, spiritual intuition, that spiritual heart. And really in humanity, it is the heart. It's the power of the heart. If the heart is centered and it's pure, it can accomplish the greatest of deeds.
During the first talk, there was a turn of phrase used about, and I've lost it again. And it was a good point. There was a turn of phrase used, something to the effect that soul comes forth in these lower kingdoms and is, regardless of the conditioning, and that there is actually one monad. There's one expression of soul and spirit, and then it begins to differentiate across stages of evolution. And until finally, in a sevening kind of effect, seven times seven times seven, we have the array of manifestation that we do right now. Well, if we turn our senses and our minds and our reason and our lower minds to everything around us on this physical plane, we're busy looking for the boss. We're busy looking at power structure and struggle for survival. When in reality, if we turn mind within and we begin to meditate and contemplate and envision the highest and best reality, what would be that deific force that generates all of this? Then we're led back to the fact that was alerted to, here it is, that upon passing, the animal returns into its universal state. It goes right into the monadic essence of being the animal or the type that it was. That's the effort we're making self-consciously in daily life as we live right now, is to turn mind and heart and senses to the spiritual, to live in the spiritual as best we can, with the confidence that we're actually part of that universal oversoul, that we are a ray of that deific essence, and therefore the big boss is that essence that comes from within as an inner guide, and that hearkens to the oneness of all of us. Despite the beautiful array of physicality this morning, aren't we gorgeous? But here we are, literally as bits of manifestation of a fragmented or radiated soul or spirit.
And we should remember, too, that we have our three higher principles, of which the monad, the Atma, and the Buddhi, and then when we call the ego, that mind, the mind principle. But the three higher principles are eternal and imperishable, where the four lower are, we're working through matter, we're working through these vehicles, and they're temporary, but we're working not just for ourselves, for our own salvation, but for all of nature, because the kingdoms below us, the ones that operate strictly on instinct, their monad, in a sense, they're not firing on all the cylinders yet. They're latent, these qualities which have flowered forth in humanity are latent in the lower kingdoms. They can show tremendous intelligence and ability, but there is something called the Antaskarana, which is the bridge. It bridges the mind. The mind is dual. It's, you know, the higher and lower mind. It's one, but it's dual in its manifestations and functions. And we need to cross that bridge called Antaskarana to wed the our lower mind with the pure spiritual intuitions of Buddhi, which is the higher mind. So the rational and the spiritual, the instinct and the intuition, it all needs to be integrated and synthesized. And then we've crossed that bridge, in a sense. Yes? You had your hand up? Did you have something else? Or this?
Well, it seems to be, we've heard in here so many times before that we are beings in evolution, and that the evolution begins within, outward. Mm-hmm. So, therefore, the ideas that we hold are the ideas that are going to manifest. So, the center is really, you know, our motive and attitude and the viewpoint we take on life as being that creative being, but we create from within outward. So the ideas that we engender or we try to understand, you know, are what begin to manifest in our life. Even, you know, if we don't try, because the ideas are what power, where the power lies. Am I speaking?
So the ideas that we hold and we really energize is what is the creative force. That's the karmic agent in this life, all the lives around us, and the lives to come. So, you know, as we walk down the street, we may be aware, it may even be instinctual, where we pick up tension in a crowd. We might realize that this is an uncomfortable scenario. We might pick up, you know, something angry about traffic. If we identify those instinctive reactions as just what they are, minor transmissions, very low grade, having to do with a physical instinct expression, but then we raise our mind off of it and say, okay, that's not for me. And we begin to think at a higher level and try to hold on to the highest, noblest thought in that moment. Where we put our energy is where we're creating the future. So if we're putting our energy on the highest and rejecting what we've sensed instinctually, we're part of a creative process that can uplift all.
And we need to, in a sense, we need to do a shaving process. We need to realize that we are not these thoughts. We are not these feelings. We are not this body. And especially if we are in a situation where we're getting, we know we're becoming too attached. We're becoming too attached to ourselves, to ideas, because reason and intellect are traps, as it were, and they will, we become attached to, in a sense, fame or just pride. When reason gets in there, pride gets in there, and reason is a byproduct of the senses and the physical brain. And it's not a quality relating to the divine spirit. So we need to use our better instincts and our intuition, especially in situations which are critical. When we reach a critical stage, wherever it may be, and we never know where it's coming because we're not omniscient beings, and we need to be able to take a breath and to think and to recenter ourselves and not to be thrown off balance. Yes.
Some of the precognitive states of the lower kingdom are even more advanced than man. Like, for instance, if an earthquake is coming or individuals having a heart attack, they can sense it hours before the average individual without training can sense this. Where's the balance in this?
You have a response?
Well, we would think that we're all intelligent and some of us are more sympathetic or empathetic and have a greater sense of compassion. And we have these powers within us. And the animal kingdom instinctually has the powers to sense danger. And they do what is appropriate. You know, they don't think about it, they just do it because it is inherent in their intelligence. So, I mean, the entire universe is intelligent and we just have different degrees. And it's, you know, we sometimes, we lose sight of the fact that if we just relax and let things be as they are, they work out rather than us sticking our nose in it and saying, well, we know better, we'll do it this way.
And therein lies the key. We know what it is, but you know what? We're going to do it our way. The anecdotal evidence of the tsunami that hit the islands many years ago now, where the water went out and stayed out, and all of a sudden they were left with a beach like never should have been there to begin with. The silence of the birds, the flight of the animals, all those things were going on in the natural environment for quite a long time before that wave hit. And so what was going on in the human kingdom? People in a relaxed situation, indigenous folks that had lived there for a very long time, actually did see all of that. They actually did sense all of that. Overrode their instinct, which should have been, uh-oh, what's going on? Let's go inland. Overrode that and decided, oh, what a great day to walk on the beach. I'm going to continue having this tasty breakfast right here where I am. Or I need to clean this next room or the boss is going to get at me. So in the human kingdom, instead of heeding natural signs and warnings like the animals do when they have automatic obedience to it and they leave, as long as they're wild and unconditioned by humans.
Yes.
In the human state, it's an ability to block something out, create a new premise, operate from that wrong premise, and come hell or high water, stick to it.
Well, yes. Is that reasoning? Is that reasoning?
That's reasoning.
Is that what we do?
That's reasoning. We reason ourselves. It's a choice. It's a free will and choice based on the wrong premise.
Okay.
I will ignore the instinct and the input of, gee, is that natural? Is there an alarm here? And I'm going to do this other thing.
But there were those that were intuitive, and they were observers of nature and the natural environment, and said, I'm going with them. You know, they know something I don't. I'm, you know, so there were people who did survive that did head for the hills, but too often we do, through reasoning, we override. We do goofy things. We do things that are contrary to our nature. We're, as the animals, they don't have that. They just know. And see, the higher part of intuition is the spiritual just knowing what is right, having all the spiritual knowledge and acting accordingly. That's what the masters of wisdom have done. They have perfected themselves through prior periods of evolution. So they don't act contrary to universal principles because they're one with the law. And they wouldn't even think about acting against their natures. In the back?
The funny thing about it was that we remember when we were young children misbehaving, telling someone that we act just like little animals. And one relative would say, nasty come out of you if you were bad. But then a strange thing happened. They put us in what they call a kindergarten or something. And by the time we reached the third and fourth and fifth grade, things began to change. And we heard ourselves saying, I didn't know I had it in me.
Mm-hmm.
How much we owe those teachers. And here, when we're given the three fundamental propositions, the Declaration and so forth, that's Greek to me. By the time I didn't know I had it in me. Can we use that as a picture of the changes that take place in the human animal?
And those changes continue to take place. Brain research is saying that in plateaus of 7 years, there are tremendous changes in the physical body and brain that we use. So the new research that it's not until the ages 26, 27, maybe 28, that the physical brain develops its full coordination with the center portion that's the bridge between the two lobes. It's a whole different concept of what it is to be using a mature brain. But at every stage, we have the conditions right and appropriate to make the effort. There's a series of articles in Magazine Theosophy, volumes 20 and 21. They were written in 1933. They're entitled In Pursuit of Self-Knowledge. And it says, in time, the searcher for the truth comes to self-watchfulness of the temper of the mind more than of the body. And that's what you're describing. Difficult as may be, and is the control of the body, its senses and tendencies, they are as nothing compared with the control of the mind, its sense and tendencies. Each feeds the other, and both dissipate the energies of the soul, so that will and faith give way to weariness and doubt. Doubt of the great purpose, doubt of oneself. The trials of life are indispensable to the acquirement of self-knowledge. The frictions of life, which derange the temper of body and mind, like the undue frictions of the mechanical instruments, call for the interjection of a frictionless medium between the working parts. That medium is altruism in motive, goodwill in mind, and brotherhood in actuality in all relations of human existence. So, advice that we can live by. See you Wednesday night, and again, the building will open at 5:15 still for library hours. The meeting itself will start at 7:30, but please, please, it's a meditative kind of commemorative session, so if you could get here a little bit early and sit in contemplation before the class begins. Thank you.